Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Sunday, January the 6th. Happy New Year. Now that everybody's sort of going back to work and going back to school tomorrow, so I hope everybody had a great holiday. Today we'll be chatting, as we like to do on Sundays, with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. There is so much to get into, starting with the Democrats, who they did take over the House, but I think they also confirmed this week that there are some really crazy people in that Democrat majority, and we'll talk a little bit about that. There are also 31 Democrats in that Democrat majority who come from districts that President Trump won in 2016, that they were able to flip, and many of them did it with a big margin of victory. So all of those Democrats have a re-election waiting for them in 2020, and you have to wonder how far to the left can they go. The American economy doing absolutely great, the politics of the shutdown, China, interesting problems, economic as well as some military expansion, and the riots are still going on in France. In fact, I understand they got bigger this weekend, so lots to get into with our friend Bill Katz. Happy New Year, Bill. Everybody gets back to normal tomorrow, I guess. I guess you will, too.
Well, I don't really know what normal is anymore, Silvio. I mean, we have a new member of Congress from New York, as we call her, Little Evita, or Sandy, as she's now being called, because her
Sandy,
Sandy, because somebody discovered her high school yearbook from Yorktown Heights. She claimed, you know, she's from the Bronx. She was born in the Bronx. But
right.
She didn't grow up in the Bronx. She grew up in Westchester County, which is the eighth most affluent county in the United States. And they found some dance videos from high school, and they found her high school entries under the name Sandy. I think that she and Beto should get together and decide what names they want to use.
I don't know too many Puerto Rican girls named Sandy.
No.
So I'll just put it that way. I mean, I don't remember, growing up Cuban, you know, Puerto Ricans are not that far apart from us in many ways. And I don't remember any Puerto Rican girls named Sandy or for that matter, any Cuban girls either. So that's an interesting name, just like I don't remember any Irish guys in El Paso named Beto either. But that's another story, you know.
Yes. Yeah. They will eventually get their names together.
Yeah, eventually. The Beto Sandy team for 2020.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And what you made the point about the Democrats coming to town, and they came to town, and I think the immediate effect was there was an enormous rise, apparently, in Washington last week of appointments to see psychiatrists. they're going to make sure that their health benefits will include psychiatry in the next version of Obamacare. Little Evita came to town, and then we have the congresswoman from Michigan who's Palestinian.
Oh, wow.
Does not seem to know how to keep her mouth shut, and she used an obscenity in reference to the president. As somebody said, though, and I think it was Jonah Goldberg, who was just on the air on Fox, the president is not in a great position to criticize people who use obscene terms. I mean, because of his own background. However, I think it did shock the people to see it actually covered on television, and then her refusal to apologize. What she should have done was apologize for the use of the word and said, but I meant the political point. The political point was they're going to impeach him. And this does not make the Democratic leadership happy because they're jumping the gun on the Mueller report. What they obviously plan is to not talk about impeachment, but then when the Mueller report is released, no matter what it says, to say, mm-hmm. well, now we have something to work with, and then go to the impeachment. I think that Trump will be impeached, by the way.
Yeah,
because
well,
I think that the Democratic
well
Party will demand it.
Yeah. Well, the base, I mean, you've got this fellow, the millionaire or billionaire, he's already running ads in Iowa calling for his impeachment, amazes me. Yeah, it still amazes me because I thought impeachment was about high crimes and misdemeanors, and you had to at least prove that something did happen. So I don't know. But you know what? When I watched that video of that lady from Michigan talking about President Trump and impeachment, the thing that really struck me, aside from the fact that apparently her son was in the audience, mm-hmm. the other thing that struck me was everybody was having such a good time. You know, she said that, and everybody was like, you know, cheering and having such a good time. And I'm sitting there saying, wow, what is wrong with these people? I mean, if somebody had said that about President Obama in a midterm, I mean, celebration or whatever, I mean, can you imagine that, say, in 2011, after President Obama had lost the House in huge numbers? Can you imagine, or the Senate in 2014, can you imagine any Republican saying something like that about President Obama? You know, we're going to impeach blank. It would have been a riot. There would have been all kinds of complaints.
Absolutely. And Nancy Pelosi refused to condemn her.
She said she's not into censorship. I love that.
Yeah, I'm not. Yes,
she said,
I'm not into
censorship. Okay,
right.
All right.
Well, she's trying to keep the hard left in line. She is soon going to learn they cannot be kept in line.
That's
you cannot
it.
Keep extremists in line. That's one of the lessons I learned in politics years ago. There are certain people, no matter what you do, they will never be satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
If they have an agenda and you give them 100%, they'll come up with a new agenda.
Right.
It's in their mentality.
That's it. And they're going to, I mean, I just saw something. I didn't follow it in detail, but I saw something that Representative Scalise and now Representative Ocasio-Cortez from New York, the Evita, as you call her, they
mm-hmm.
they engaged in a debate about taxes on Twitter. And Scalise finally said, look, I can't go on. All I hear from people defending you is obscenities, and you know, nobody wants to have a debate. They just want to call you a racist, or they just want to call you a sexist, or they just want to call you whatever. So they don't want to have a debate about anything. They don't want to sit down and say, okay, this is why I believe that taxes should be raised or whatever. They just, if you disagree with them, well, you're immediately branded this or that, and I don't know how you have a conversation like that, Bill. How can you have a conversation with someone who immediately attacks you of being this or that, Bill?
Well, that has become the nature of American politics.
Yes,
I don't think it's the first time. I don't think it's the first time. I do think that in the past there was more of a tendency, though, on the part of the press to not report some of these ridiculous, extreme comments, who either look the other way or to pass them off. Nowadays, everything gets reported because of the Internet. So people
mm-hmm.
are aware of these things. I mean, this is not the first time we've seen hatred in American politics. We saw plenty of it during the Roosevelt administration. I like to tell the story. Well, I don't like to tell it, but I do tell it, of my father, who was on a train on April 12, 1945, he was involved in war production, and the conductor came through and said, I regret to tell you that the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, has died. And my father said half the car burst into applause. I mean, just can you imagine that? This was a wartime leader of a victorious army. But hatred is common in politics. We have tried in the past to keep it under some control, and one reason was that the political parties kept it under some control.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not forget the fact that the Democratic Party that nominated John F. Kennedy in 1960 was a segregationist party,
mm-hmm.
and it nominated him. And there was plenty of racism in that party. Hate had a home in that party. Hate had a home in certain parts of the Republican Party. I mean, William F. Buckley Jr. spent a good part of his lifetime fighting bigotry on the right, and he should be commended for it. And there was kind of an understanding, we're not going to go there anymore. But here we are back doing pretty much the same thing.
Well, what amazes me about all of this is, you're right. I mean, there's always been hatred. Human nature is human nature. So we're never going to live in perfect times. But I just, you know, what I don't understand is how some of these people get all of this attention. I mean, this young woman from New York, whenever she speaks, she doesn't sound very smart. I mean, she's eloquent, yes. She's very telegenic, yes. But she's not very smart, the things that she says. I mean, I was listening to something. She's proposing, I guess, a 70% tax increase or something to pay for climate change. I'm paraphrasing what she was saying, but something like that. And I wish that some reporter would ask her, well, Miss Sandy, I guess that's her name Sandy, do you know what's going on in Paris? Are you familiar with what's going on in Paris? Are you familiar with that? And yet they never get those questions. They get these questions about, well, gee, you know, what about this? But they never get questions like that. And I think if this young woman ever came into an interview with a good reporter, he or she would tear her up. She looked foolish by the time the interview was over. So foolish that she'd be begging the network not to run the interview, Bill.
Well, if they was a really tough reporter. Apparently she was interviewed by Margaret Hoover on her program, and it was a tough interview, and she failed horribly. But she knows she will be protected by the American press. One, she's a liberal and a socialist, and there are plenty among the press. Second, she is seen as a woman of color. She really kind of, I mean, she's half and half, but she's seen as a woman of color, and there will be a certain immunity there. And third, to be perfectly frank about it, many of the reporters don't know much more than she does.
Right.
I mean, you have a lot of reporters running around today who are very uninformed. The great myth in journalism, or the great myth about journalism, is these reporters really know their stuff in Washington. Most of them don't. There are some who do, and there are some who really are good historians, but many do not. She actually was a good student in school. She graduated very high in her class at Boston University. However, she doesn't inform herself. She doesn't read. She doesn't know anything about history. She doesn't know anything about economics. That's for sure. I saw a column this week by a person learned in medical economics, pointing out that the whole Obamacare Medicare for Air for All. Isn't it interesting? They call it Medicare for All, not Obamacare for All. I wonder why.
Obamacare didn't really go to all. In fact, nobody can afford the premiums, Bill.
Well, that's the point. And also, writer was pointing out some of the provisions that they want to put in. One would be to reduce payments to hospitals and doctors. For goodness sake, that is one of the last things you'd ever want to do, especially to doctors who may be affluent, but the practical effect of reducing payments to doctors will be to drive a lot of potential doctors out of the system. They'll say it's just not worth the medical investment or the financial investment to become a doctor if this is what they're going to do, and the instability that goes with it. And we know what that will do. There are doctor shortages in European countries. Another thing that apparently is a provision of the Obamacare or Medicare for All is that they will decimate private drug companies, you know, cut their profits and everything. And this writer was saying the practical effect of that would be to reduce the number of life-saving drugs that are produced because they have to be developed. It takes over $1 billion, with a B, to bring a drug to market. And with that kind of money involved, if they are going to just be cut and cut and cut, what will happen is they simply won't develop some of these drugs. They'll go for the sure things. And that will essentially reduce the amount of progress we've made as a result of prescription drugs. You know, one of the greatest cost-saving developments in the history of medicine was the development of prescription drugs, because the one effect of prescription drugs is to reduce hospital stays dramatically. We now do things medically with drugs that we used to do with hospital stays and surgery, and the savings have been enormous. What if that can't go on? What if the drug companies simply stop developing? and that would be the result of their finances being cut. Now, but there may be some room there. I'm sure some of them do gouge. I'm not turning them into heroes. There are things that could clearly be corrected. But these people have no concept of what they're dealing with.
Well, also, drug companies are major employers in the United States. I mean, this is something that we cannot forget. I mean, there's lots and lots of people involved in sales and research, and these are large employers. And before you start downsizing them, I mean, before these people start calling for the downsizing of them, just think about it, the number of people who are going to be let go. But I keep coming back to the same thing. I mean, they keep talking about, you know, we want to lower, you know, we want to reduce healthcare costs. Well, yeah, I guess we all want that. But the reason that the healthcare costs are what they are to some extent is because Obamacare didn't deliver any of the promises that it made. And I've always felt, Bill, that the best solution to health care in the United States has been, or should be, to give people tax credits so they can buy their own private insurance. That means that anybody, I don't care how much money you make, if you make $10,000, we're going to give you a tax credit so that you can buy insurance for yourself or for your family. So you eliminate the idea that some people do not have coverage, because that's not good for society to have people who don't have coverage and show up in emergency and so on. That's not good. But, you know, you provide tax credits, and I think that's the way to do it. I know back in 2008 when McCain was running against Obama, that's what McCain was basically proposing, just give people tax credits. And I've always felt that's the best way to go, Bill. It's not
that
a
is.
Perfect way. But at
that
least
is.
you're providing – everybody has the opportunity to buy private health insurance if you do that, Bill.
That's true. And what the Democrats want to do, Bernie Sanders in particular, is he wants to eliminate all private insurance. Now, I don't love insurance companies any more than anyone else loves insurance companies. They're companies. And there is no question that they vary in quality. But, of course, that's the whole point, that if you have at least some part of the system private, you have competition. And competition is good. It drives down prices. And it increases quality, because companies have to compete with each other for services and for clients and for customers. That's good. If you have Medicare for all, you have what effect is the British system, which is the government controls everything, and the Canadian system, which apparently does not work that well at all. Many people who are affluent in Canada come to the United States for health care, and that negates the whole idea, but for some reason people don't see it. I think what impresses people, or what attracts people to the Medicare for all nonsense, is the concept that it's going to be free. It's not going to be free.
Right.
Somebody has to pay for it. You're going to pay for it through premiums, which will be dramatically increased. you will pay for it in other ways. You will pay for it through inefficiency. Right now, if you are a patient in America, even a poor patient, and you have a critical medical problem and need an operation, you will have it that week. In other countries, they have a quality of misery and a quality of suffering, but they're equal. We're so equal here that there are Western countries where there are 40-week waits for an operation. Not only is that a terrible risk medically, but psychologically, that if you get sick, you don't even know when you can be treated. It depends on what the equal healthcare system tells you. And what you have is the equality of mediocrity.
That's right. Well, we have a lot of Canadians here in Texas. And, in fact, at our church, there are several Canadians who live here. And when you talk to them, what they tell you about their healthcare system is, yes, it's really good. If you have something, like, really bad, like if you have a heart attack or something like that, yes, they'll take you in and it's going to be cheaper than here. But if you have to wait for if you have something less than that, like you say, an operation, then what a lot of Canadians do, not just the wealthy, but a lot of middle-class Canadians do, is they drive to the United States, and they'll go to a private clinic and get that done here. So that's the reality. Obviously, they cannot drive to the United States from Europe, so you know they have to wait the 40 weeks or whatever. But I continue to say that I want to see everybody have health insurance, and I still think the fairest way to do it, the best way to do it, is to simply say, we're going to give you a tax credit of so much for you to buy coverage, And in some cases, for people under a certain income, it turns out to be free, pretty much. But that way, they've got health insurance, private health insurance. I also want to say something about Bernie Sanders wanting to nationalize the hospitals or whatever. I think a lot of that has to do with the public sector union, because if all of a sudden you take a hospital and it's no longer private, now everybody in a sense works for Medicare, well, all of those doctors, all of those nurses, everybody in that hospital now is a candidate for the public sector union, whatever the union is. And I think that's why the Democrats, they see that as a benefit for them, Bill. I'm being cynical, but I really believe that.
Absolutely. The more people you put on the public payroll, the more votes the Democrats will get, because they are the ones who employ them. It is said often that the state of California, politically, can be swung simply by the public service unions, which means that you are the governor is negotiating when a new contract comes up with the public service union. He is negotiating with the people who put him in office.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
That's no way to conduct a negotiation. When public service unions were founded, there were many, even in the labor movement, in the union movement, that opposed it. Franklin Roosevelt opposed public service unions. I remember when the teachers' unions got started in the early 60s, there was great opposition and a lot of fear as to what they would result in. Now, to a certain extent, the society provoked some of these things by paying teachers salaries much smaller than those that they should have received. But the net effect of public service unions and in public teacher unions is to make the teacher a creature not of education and of scholarship and of teaching students, but a creature of the unions. And that is that's exactly what's happened.
That's exactly right. And then you have to wonder whose loyalty, where is the loyalty of the union? Is it to the parents who are trying to get their kids educated, or is it to the teachers? I'm sure that, there's lots of good teachers, lots of good people in education, but you do have to wonder sometimes about the union having that much power. We're going to take a little break, Bill, and then when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the Democrats and talk a little bit about the economy. Great numbers that came out Friday. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Sunday, January the 6th, talking with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Bill, before we get back into the politics, I just wanted to give you wanted you to have a little bit of fun with a little bit of Brooklyn Dodgers history. I know you like that. On this day, Ralph Branca, the great pitcher that you remember with the Dodgers, was born on this day in 1926. He died in 2016. And sadly, he's always going to be remembered, I guess, for that one pitch he gave up or that pitch he threw in that game, Bill, that became his signature moment, as they say.
Well, sadly, that was the shot heard around the world. And I remember it because baseball was so big where I lived in New York that when the Dodgers or the Yankees or the New York Giants were playing in championship games, playoffs or World Series, they would suspend classes and you listened on the public address system to the game.
Wow.
And it was just incredible. And those were really highly ranked schools. But baseball was a ritual in New York. It really was. And I remember that our math class was suspended so we could hear the playoffs between the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers for the pennant. And this was the winning game. This was the game that would decide it. And, of course, there was that moment when I think it was in the ninth inning when Bobby Thompson
bottom of the ninth,
came up.
Yeah.
And he hit the shot heard around the world, off rank Ralph Branca, off Ralph Branca, and won the pennant for the New York Giants. And my next class after math was gym. So we went to the gym class, and the coach, the old coach, it was right out of a movie, said he was ready with the basically the obituary because we, most of us were Dodger fans, and we were grim and glum and felt that the world had collapsed and maybe there wasn't going to be a tomorrow. And he said, well, some people call this luck, and some people call this skill. And I remember thinking to myself, and some people call it losing.
That's right. That's right. Well, the other little memory I wanted to bring up, Dodgers memory, Brooklyn Dodgers memory, although this one actually went with the team to the West Coast also, and that's Vin Scully, who began, he was signed by the Dodgers on this day in 1950 to be a part of the booth, I guess, in the following season, 51. But Vin Scully, of course, went on to L.A., and he called baseball games until 2017. 67 seasons, Bill. That is amazing. And
it is,
he sounded just as good. He sounded just as good in 2017 as he did in 1980, and I'm sure as he did back in the 50s, Bill.
Oh, yes. I've never seen a career like that. We had, of course, some world-class broadcasters in New York in the 1950s. Red Barber, who of course, the old redhead.
How about
the old
that?
Redhead.
Right.
Well, no, how about that was Mel Allen.
That's
Mel
right.
Allen, yes,
right.
That was Mel
yeah.
Allen. We had Mel Allen. How about that? And we had a few others. But the Dodger booth was actually very unstable, and Red Barber had made a few threats to quit because he felt he wasn't being treated well, he wasn't being paid enough. Considering that he was the voice of the Brooklyn Dodgers. But he stayed on. I don't recall when it was that he left. Maybe it was when the Dodgers finally left Brooklyn in 1957. But as you said, Scully went with them. There was a third, Connie Desmond, who I think had some medical problems. But I don't think we've ever had names like that.
No.
These were literally the voices of their teams. Mel Allen, who also was sidetracked later on. I mean, they were treated not all that well. Mel Allen was the voice of the New York Yankees, and Red Barber was the voice of the Brooklyn Dodgers. I don't recall, I think Russ Hodges was the announcer for the New York Giants. The New York Giants were the third team in New York, and for whatever reason never had the traction that the other two teams had. But many of them were followed, by the way, by player announcers. Players who became broadcasters, and some of them, like Phil Rizzuto, did a good job, and of course they knew the game so well. But that was the era back in the 50s of sports broadcasting, because sports really were sports. I mean, you didn't have players making millions of dollars. You had players making normal people salaries, and a World Series bonus was like $8,000. And they drove to the ballpark in Pontiacs, not like it is today. And it really was a sport. Baseball was a sport. I mean, it was a business. Of course it was a business. And that's the reason, actually, the Dodgers left Brooklyn, because they felt there was better business out in Los Angeles. But there was still an aura of fun about it, an aura of the players would live in the neighborhoods. You would see the Brooklyn Dodger players at Lundy's after the games. Lundy's was a very famous seafood restaurant in Brooklyn, and it was understood that they would be left alone by the public, and they were. and I don't think we've ever gotten back that atmosphere. I really don't.
No, that was a very special, very, very special time for baseball and New York. Just an absolutely, it was a moment in time, and you were fortunate to experience it, or at least sometime, for some years. And I think it must have been absolutely wonderful to be a baseball fan at that time in New York. Well, getting back to the serious stuff, the Democrats had have a real problem, I think, in the House, aside from the fact that they may have a few crazies. But I think they have real divisions. I was reading an article this week, Bill, that there's 31 Democrats who were elected in very competitive districts, most of them by less than 2 points, in very competitive elections where they benefited to some extent of this great Democrat enthusiasm that, you know, obviously benefited many Democrats in close elections, lots of money that they had. And all of these guys have to run for re-election in 2020, and they're going to have to come back to districts where Nancy Pelosi is not popular.
No.
And districts where I don't think – I mean, if these guys want to get re-elected, they better not go to the left. And I'm saying all of this because I believe that the politics of the shutdown is eventually going to benefit President Trump, because of Democrats like this who don't really want to have a fight over border security, because that's not an argument that they would win in their districts, Bill. So I think Speaker Pelosi, she's going to have to need magic to get this done, Bill.
I think, yes. However, we always should point out, and I agree with a lot of what you said, in fact, of all of it, but we also point out that the Democrats have one enormous advantage. They have the press on their side. And while I think most Americans have learned to discount a good part of what the press says, and properly so, there are some who are still very much influenced by press coverage. And the press has literally become a branch of the Democratic Party. And that is hurting the president.
Well, certainly in the coverage of the news, I mean, look at the focus on, you know, a couple of Republicans say that, you know, say this or that, and they immediately focus on them and saying there's divisions in the Republican Party. And look, I think both sides, my feeling is both sides would be better off coming up with a deal here and fixing the shutdown. But I just think that for President Trump, this is more important. He cannot cave in. I think he's committed to going the distance here, and if he caves in, I think he's the one who's got problems, Bill.
I think that's true. Well, the base of the Republican Party is demanding that he not cave in. They're basically saying, take a stand on this one issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the signature issue, building the wall. This is the one you ran on, and you must not back down. And I think he feels that. On the other hand, the Democratic Party is saying to its representatives, we elected you because you're anti-Trump, and you better stay anti-Trump. And I think this is a very tough situation. It really is. The parties are polarized. They also dislike each other personally.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that either party has one leader that it can turn to that can unify the party, because Trump is somewhat controversial in the Republican Party, and the Democratic Party, as we've said, has so many people running for president that they're going to have a meeting in Yankee Stadium,
right,
unless they
right.
run out of seats. And,
it's right.
really quite ridiculous when you – I mean, every day there's somebody else who says, I may just make the run. On the basis of what? On the basis of what?
Yeah. Well, on the basis, I guess, that they think it's their time to run. But what I find interesting is how little substance there is to their message. It's the same, you know, it's the same idea that Trump is corrupt and the economy is not fair and, you know, we're for the middle class. I mean, there's really nothing of substance in what they're saying. I mean, there's nothing there. I mean, it seems like they're all running for Congress. It doesn't seem like they're running for president. Well, there's no national security message. It's all about Trump. And I just don't think that's going to work. I don't think that's going to work. I really don't.
I think you make a very, very good point. They are now so trapped into their so-called narrative that they must be the anti-Trump party and oppose everything that he does, that I agree with you. At some point that people, even with the biased press that we have, at some point that people are going to find out that they have elected a bunch of do-nothings who just sit
mm-hmm.
around hating Trump. And I think that Pelosi might be aware of this. I don't know if there's anything she can do about it, but she's a pretty savvy person, and she may very well be aware of it. But, yes, you're absolutely correct.
I mean, you look at, for example, this week, Elizabeth Warren. I guess she's saying that she's running for president. Well, she's forming an exploratory committee. Down here in Texas, Joaquin Castro, who's one of the Castro twins, is running for president, I guess, and he's forming a committee. There's so many of them running, but when you listen to them, it's just the same. It's very much of a Bernie Sanders message. That's kind of what I'm hearing. And I just don't see that working. I mean, again, I'm biased. I recognize that. I recognize that I'm on the other side. But I don't see a good message coming out. I mean, I wish that there was, if they had a Democrat, for example, like the guy who's the governor of Kentucky, or somebody like that who's a, you know, kind of a more centrist Democrat who can appeal to a larger audience, then that I'd be concerned. But I don't see anybody in that group that can defeat Trump with all his problems. He's got a ton of them.
Yes. I happen to agree with you. I think that there are two people out there on the three who are out there on the Democratic side who have a shot. One is Biden, only because if the public really turns on Trump, at least Biden is semi-respectable. You know, you don't know what his medical condition will be, but at least he's semi-respectable. He's been vice president. He didn't blow up the world. I think he has a shot. I think Beto has a shot only because he will be run as a personality, and unfortunately, there are some voters, and maybe a lot of them, who are very susceptible to that. You saw it in Texas. I mean, here's a man who really has no substance, but he came rather close to defeating Ted Cruz. Now, it's true that Cruz is not Mr. Popularity, but I think that based on personality alone, he might very well have a shot. Again, this assumes that Trump goes south, that the economy goes south, and that he's vulnerable. Now, we talked before we went on the air about this boomlet that Daily Mail of Britain is reporting for Michelle Obama. Now, I cannot think of a single qualification that Michelle Obama has to be president except that she knows the house. You know, I mean, she knows where the kitchen is, and she knows where everything is.
Right.
She has the drape measurements. But aside from that, she never indulged in policies outside family policies when she was first lady. However, if she says, okay, I'm going to do it, because there apparently are people pressuring her to do it, that shuts down the rest of the party.
Right.
That shuts down the rest of the party. A lot of people will feel, I can't oppose her. She's Barack Obama's wife. She's black. She's female. How can I oppose her? And that could result in a nomination under certain circumstances. I don't know how it would play in the general election. I really don't. Again, I think what we're talking about here is a race where everything depends on the economy and the standing of Donald Trump.
Right. Yeah, it's his to lose.
That's
as
right.
They like to say in sports, it's his to lose at the moment. But the economy is doing quite well. The stock market had a crazy up and down, but apparently it's okay now, or doing better now. My friends in the stock market industry tell me that what we're seeing is more of a correction. They're saying that 2017 went up too much and that a correction was coming. I don't know if they're right or wrong, but that's what they're saying, and they're pretty serious people. But assuming that's true, assuming the stock market is a correction and you won't have these crazy swings, and assuming the American economy continues to create jobs, I think Trump's got a pretty good argument for re-election. I mean, what are the Democrats going to say? The economy's not good. Wages are going up. That's a big news. That was the biggest story, I think, out of Friday. 3% increase in wages. That was a big story.
And that is also, I think, a very much underrated talking point for the Republican Party, that for the first time in a long time, actual wages are going up. And if Trump can arrange some kind of tax cut proposal for the middle class, that will increase his power. But, you know, we're talking about an election that is almost 2 years away.
Right.
A lot can happen in those 2 years. A lot can happen in 1 week. And we don't know who's going to be around in 2020. We don't know what the state of the world is going to be, the state of the economy. And so what we're doing right now, actually, is having a little fun with advanced talk. By the end of this year, we should have a pretty good idea of who's going to run for president. on the Democratic side and who has an actual chance of getting the nomination. And it can be bloody. I mean, it really can be bloody. We should also have, of course, the Mueller report and whether or not the president can survive. We don't know what's in the Mueller report. I can't see on what grounds he could be removed, but they could find grounds. So there are so many things that are up for grabs, and what we're doing now is a kind of playful speculation. That's all it can be at this stage.
Right. It's all preseason talk, as they say,
sure.
You know, in sport. It's all preseason talk because, like you say, you know, that we have to wait for the games to be played. But there are a couple of situations that are real situations that will have an impact in the short run. One is the politics of the shutdown, the government shutdown. I don't know. I mean, again, you know, we live here in Texas and we don't have that much influence of government, you know, of government like they would in Washington. But I don't, you know, you drive around, you go out to eat, you watch football games. I don't see any big impact, at least from the shutdown. It seems to me the shutdown is very much of an impact in Washington, I would think. And if I was working for the federal government and I wasn't getting paid, it'd be a big deal for me. But I still think it's a very small part of the government, and I'm not sure how much it hurts people. So if Trump decides that he's going to really go the distance here and, let's say, do it for several months, I'm not sure that people would be that upset about it, Bill.
Well, you know, again, it's that old story of what will they feel in their own lives? And, of course, what will they see on their television screens when they, you know, the television networks, especially CNN, will be out there every day trying to prove that if this goes on one more day, the country will collapse and Earth will fall out of its orbit and collide with Pluto. I mean, this is the way these people report the news anyway. It is disgraceful. It is an embarrassment to journalism. But a certain number of people will believe it. But they have to feel it first. They have to feel it on their own skin. And that may be a long way off.
Well, I guess the only way you could feel it is if you're looking for a passport. I understand
that
if you're looking for a passport, you may not be able to get one because of the shutdown. So that would affect some people. Or if you've got some documents pending that this agency is working on. In that sense, I think people could be impacted, but I still think that's a small number of people. Bill, you've been covering, talking about issues that are very much right now in the news. You've been talking a great deal about China lately on Urgent Agenda, and I think China is an economic threat to the United States, but it's also becoming a military threat. There's even talk of China going into Taiwan, which, of course, would present President Trump with a crisis of global proportions, if I could put it that way, Bill.
That would be a repeat of the situation in 1960 when Nixon ran against Kennedy. And one of the issues in the campaign was whether or not the United States of America would defend two islands off the coast of China, Quemoy and Matsu, which belonged to Taiwan. Now, Taiwan used to be called Formosa, and it was the place to which the Chinese island, to which the nationalist government escaped when it was driven out of mainland China by the communists in 1949. And you could have a repeat of that. The Chinese are very serious about building their military, and they are absolutely determined about it. They are building modern ships. They are building modern planes. They are building hypersonic missiles. There are concerns in the United States that maybe our Navy isn't as powerful as we think it is because we don't know what missiles they are building that could knock out some of our carriers rather quickly. I've always been concerned about aircraft carriers. They're behemoths. They're huge ships. They are vulnerable. We think we have them well defended, but we may not. And yes, it is true. It's a major military threat, and that Chinese military club can just be carried around and used against us as a theoretical weapon in negotiations. It's something to worry about, and seriously so.
Yeah, well, it's also something that I wonder how many Americans know that we have a defense treaty with Taiwan to protect them in case of that. I mean, those of us who grew up during the Cold War, we knew that. I mean, I always knew that. like with South Korea. But I think there's probably a lot of Americans who would say something like, well, it's none of our business. Let them take over. I mean, it's not our business to die defending Taiwan. So
yes.
That's another problem. I think, you know, that a lot of times these foreign policy issues never seem to get any debate publicly because everybody's obsessed with Mueller. But there's a lot of issues out there, whether it's Iran, whether it's Korea, whether it's China, Taiwan. We need to be having conversations about these issues in our politics because they could hit the front page in any day, Bill.
They can, and I think that is fairly typical of our handling of foreign policy issues. You know, the point has been made a number of times that before the Second World War, there was not that much discussion of foreign policy. We think mm-hmm. there is now because of the recollections about the America First movement and the isolationists. But in fact, one of the causes of World War II was the Depression because it took people's attention away from foreign policy. We weren't watching things as carefully as we should have been watching them, and we weren't as precise as we should have been about our intelligence before World War II. But yes, foreign policy seems to have taken a back seat to just about everything. People don't want to talk about it, or they don't consider the issues before us to be that pressing, and they may be in for the shock of their lives.
Well, especially if all of a sudden one day, you know, China, you know, goes into Taiwan. And
absolutely.
Now I think that, as I was telling a friend of mine today, we were exchanging some emails today about this, and I sent an email to a friend of mine, and I said that China may underestimate Taiwan. I mean, Taiwan also has a pretty good army. Now, it's smaller,
yes.
of course. But I think Taiwan, like Israel, will fight to the last person.
Yes.
And China may find itself in a bigger problem than they realize. I've always felt that this is the reason why China hasn't done it before, because I think they know that they're going to be in for a heck of a fight, Bill.
Well, there were several things we know about China. One is that they do not fear us as a ground army because there's no
mm-hmm.
way to invade China. It's just too huge and too populous, and we learned that bitter lesson in the Korean War when the Chinese entered and pushed us back. They have unlimited manpower. The second thing we learn is that China has its problems. China
right.
is a very, very hard country to govern. Its economy right now is not doing too well. Apparently their favorite American car is the Buick, which tells me they don't know as much about engineering as they should. They have never really fielded modern electronic computerized weapons against the United States, where we do really excel. They may not do that well, or what they may do very well. But the question is, what would be their objective? Now, they could have several objectives should they decide to risk a war with the United States. One would be Taiwan, which would be a very important objective to them historically. Another would be simply control of the areas in the Western Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
Then that would be not for trade purposes and also because they want it that way. So impossible to say. You know, again,
that's
things
right.
happen. On June 24th, 1950, most Americans never heard of a place called South Korea. A day later,
mm-hmm.
South Korea was invaded, and it became one of the most familiar names in the American vocabulary.
That's right. Now, just at that time, of course, it was not known as South Korea, right? It was just known as Korea.
No,
it became
no, it was
South
no,
Korea.
No, 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 it
was, oh,
it was
known
as South Korea. There were two nations.
Oh, okay,
two
I didn't
nations.
Realize that.
North
okay,
and
I
South
didn't
Korea.
Realize. Okay, I didn't realize. I thought it became two nations after the war. Well, Bill, another country that has been in the news again this weekend is France with the riots. It seems like they're picking up again. And it's interesting because we were talking before about this young woman from New York who was talking about raising taxes for climate change or whatever. Somebody needs to point out to her what's happening in France because there's a massive rebellion going on in that country over taxes, Bill, and a lot of it is because of taxes over climate change, Bill.
That's right. It's interesting that there were several articles this week in the World's Press about the revolt throughout the world, a popular revolt against climate change legislation and the taxes that go with them. And I think one of the reasons is that people are very skeptical about what benefits would accrue. I think there is some skepticism out in the public about climate change. I think there is a sense that a lot of money is being made on the issue and that the world may not be ready to take on climate change. It may not have the technology.
Right.
Once you commit to something, and it's, these projects are enormously expensive.
Well, and they always tell you that in 100 years, you know, the East Coast is going to flood. Well,
yes.
Okay. Yeah, in 100 years it may not. So, I mean, it's one of these things where these predictions are so far advanced that, you know, you're asking people to pay more for their electricity bill so that there's not a flood 100 years from now. That's a very difficult political message, Bill.
There's not a lot of votes in that message.
And
they always manage to make the speech about the dangers of a global warming in the middle of a blizzard. You know, so people look outside and see 20 inches of snow, and they say, "I'm not worried. I really am not worried." It's a slow-moving crisis. It's very hard to deal with. It really is. It's hard to keep people interested. It's hard to convince them that the predictions are accurate because a number of the predictions have not been accurate. I think that it is going to be an issue that can drag down governments. It already, as you pointed out, is dragging down governments in Europe. I would imagine there would be other governments, possibly including our own, that could be dragged down over the issue of climate change.
Well, and climate change is apparently going to be a big issue when the Democrats have their debates this summer, I guess, at MSNBC, when they have their first debate. I guess they're going to have to have more than one debate. They'll have to have like three of them because so many people running, they'll have to break them up into three groups. But climate change is going to be one of their big issues. And they need to be careful what they wish for because I'm not sure that's going to sell well. You know, raising taxes to pay for climate change, I don't think it's a political winner. I really don't.
I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, as we look at next week, everybody's back in town now, I guess. So everything is back to normal.
Yes.
I would think the shutdown is the big story, but there may be other things too, like always, Bill.
Well, I believe the new year actually begins tomorrow, and that this last week was kind of an intermediate. You know, a lot of them were on vacation.
Right.
Nancy Pelosi was in Hawaii, and she says it's not a vacation because it's part of the United States.
I really
think that was too smart a comment to make. I mean, I think Sandy from the Bronx, I believe was also away. I think the lady from Michigan was probably somewhere in terrorist training or something. They really do have a bunch. Yes, it begins in earnest. They'll start hearing from their constituents about the shutdown. But I think that Trump has a winning issue in border security, and he has to articulate it very well, which is not necessarily his strong point. But I think that the Democrats may be miscalculating if they think that their position on this is popular. It's not. Their position is basically open borders, and I don't think that it is a particularly popular position. In fact, we know from late polling, there was a poll that was released this morning, a respected poll, saying that only 7% of Americans don't think illegal immigration is an important issue. And that's not something that should make the Democrats happy.
I thought it was very funny, Bill, that President Trump was tweeting today about this topic of the border, and he was using the words of President Obama and then Senator Clinton. I thought that was pretty bright or smart of him to do it. But to me, the funniest thing of the week, Bill, the funniest thing was somebody in this new Congress was suggesting or wanted to pass a bill saying that President Trump should release 10 years of his taxes. And one of our friends over at Powerline said, well, why don't we have Nancy Pelosi released 10 years of her taxes? I mean, her husband is a pretty successful businessman. I wonder what advantages he took from the tax laws over the last 10 years. So I thought that was pretty good. I mean, if you're going to make Trump release 10 years, why doesn't Nancy Pelosi release 10 years
Bill? That's right. Look, the Democratic strategy is not well thought out. They don't really have a program for America. You know, people look back on Newt Gingrich's Contract with America, and don't realize how effective it was. It was kind of
That's
dull.
Right.
It wasn't the most interesting idea. But, you know, they said about Gingrich and the Republicans at that time, the same thing they said about Reagan. I may not agree with everything he says or does, but at least he has beliefs. The only Democratic belief, as you pointed out on this program, is get rid of Trump, and that's it.
Well, that's right. I mean, and look, on their first day on the job, Bill, they decided to really focus on important things like eliminating the Electoral College and reducing the presidential pardon powers.
Yes.
Well,
this is something
I mean,
on everybody's mind. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what everybody's thinking around. I mean, that's what everybody's talking about. Well, a couple of details with respect to that. They're going to need amendments to the Constitution to make those two things happen. So that would take, assuming it got out of the House, out of the Senate, and the president would sign it, it would take probably 10 years to do it. So, I mean, that, again, that really tells you how little they have in the tank. And in both of those cases, it's anti-Trump that is really driving this. It's President Trump pardoning himself that is driving this, or the fact that Hillary Clinton was defeated by the Electoral College. So it's always about Trump. Everything they do is about Trump, and I think they need to reconsider that strategy, Bill.
Well, I don't think the word consider and the name Democratic Party go well together anymore.
No.
I mean, it's a party of shriekers. And,
that's it.
I mean, somebody made a point about Elizabeth Warren in Iowa, because she's already visiting Iowa. And one of the party leaders there said she shrieks. That may not go down well with people. No, it doesn't go down well with people. And
no.
Now,
I don't think
now,
she's a very good. I don't think she's a very good speaker anyway. I mean, I don't think that Elizabeth Warren would be somebody that you would enjoy listening to. Even putting politics aside, doesn't strike me as a lady that you would enjoy listening to. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
No,
I don't think
scold.
So, Bill.
She's a scold, and people don't like to elect a scold.
I thought it was funny. Somebody asked her in Iowa about the DNA test. And she said that she's not a lady of color. Well, we're happy to know that. We're very happy to know that, Bill.
Yes, I hadn't noticed that before, had you?
That's right, yeah. That's right. I mean, that was a real shock to me to find out that she's not a lady of color. Well, Bill, I think we'll have a lot to talk about this year. As
we will.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for your time. Have a great week. We'll end of the weekend, and we'll keep up with Urgent Agenda during the week and look forward to our next time, Bill.
I look forward very much to next Sunday. We will have plenty to talk about.
That's right. That's exactly. Maybe the Patriots will win next weekend. They're one of the teams that will play next weekend, Bill.
Well,
so that
should
be interesting.
I'm a semi-Patriots fan. I don't really follow football, but if there was a team that I would follow, it would probably be the Patriots because they're local. Maybe I will indulge myself and look in, especially now that that people are staying off their knees.
They're playing football for a change, which is probably why people are watching in good numbers again. Bill, thank you so much for everything, and good night, and thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
All right. Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. I always have a lot of fun talking with Bill. Again, congratulations to the Colts, to the Cowboys, to the Chargers, and to the Philadelphia Eagles for winning the four games this weekend. There's more another set of games coming up next weekend, so it should be a lot of fun. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio Cantu in Dallas.